From Oregon to Alabama, Alaska to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, unemployment statistics for the month of August are out and give us a glimpse into the health of the U.S. economy. Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with analysis. Congress is returning to session with the federal budget due by October 1st, but a battle over spending is underway. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Will the recent downgrade in the U.S. credit rating affect green energy subsidies? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets the answer from Philip Rossetti of the R Street Institute. And Americans continue to vote with their feet, moving from high-tax states to low-tax states. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. August unemployment numbers give us some insight into how the Federal Reserve's efforts to cool the economy and tame inflation are progressing. Sean Higgins is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He is here with a look at the numbers. Sean, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Sean, we have numbers now as to what the unemployment rate in the United States was in the month of August. So tell us what the numbers show.
Well, the numbers were 3.8% for the official rate, which was something of a jump from the previous month at 3.5%. And there's basically two things going on there. One is there was one significant U.S. company went under in the last month, and that's Yellow Corporation Trucking. And that pretty much accounts for all the losses in the transportation industry sector. The other thing is, as my colleague Ryan Young noted, a lot of the people are basically responding to the higher wages that are being offered for jobs. Wages have gone up for about 4 cents a month consistently for several months now, and they're responding to that, and that means that more people have gone from the, I don't think I'll be looking for a job, to, yeah, they're now actually out looking for a job, and therefore they show up in the statistics. And so that sort of is the other thing that explains the jump. We still have an incredibly tight labor market. It's worth pointing out that 3.8% is still close to the historic lowest we've ever had. It wasn't that long ago that economists thought 5% was functional full employment.
Looking back then, Sean, here over the last few months of the year, maybe going back to February, January, what has the trend line been? Has the unemployment rate continued to drop, or are we holding somewhat steady?
We've been holding steady for most of the year. It's hovered around between 3.8% and about 3.4% for the last several months. The interesting thing is there's still a lot of employers out there looking, scratching for people to hire, and the workforce participation rate has gone up in the last month, it has sort of remained a bit stubbornly low for a long period of time. And it's apparently just a sort of cultural shift. A lot of people just decided they don't want to look for work, or they're more happy working from home or doing piecemeal gig economy type jobs that don't show up on the reports. Or they're just at home homeschooling their kids or just taking care of them generally. The COVID-19 crisis created a lot of sort of disruption, and it forced a lot of people into alternate arrangements that some of them have just decided they're not going to go back to the old ways of doing it. So that's part of what we're seeing here. It's a very unusual sort of market. The whole sort of culture and economy has shifted, and people are still sort of figuring out the implications of that.
What are the implications then for businesses of an unemployment rate this low? Are businesses still experiencing difficulty in finding qualified employees? Do we see that as a major business problem?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why, despite it being so low, they're still struggling is that a lot of people are able to find work, but a lot of companies have a hard time finding the particular skilled labor they need. We've had a problem where we've turned out a lot of college graduates, but we haven't had people in a lot of sort of skilled trades that have to be learned through apprenticeships and that type of stuff. And there's a lot of those places that are looking out there. There's also a lot of sort of highly skilled technical positions that require undergraduate degrees and stuff. And they're also searching for people to do that. You know, they're putting up wages have gone up significantly in a lot of these things. But they're still having a hard time finding it because there just literally aren't that many people out there who have both the skills and the sort of inclination to do it. And as a consequence, the other thing we're seeing as a consequence of that is an increase in sort of labor activity. The unions see how tight the labor market is and how much management is dependent on, is struggling just to find and fill positions, and they see that that gives them leverage, and that's why we're seeing things like, you know, the strikes with UPS and the auto workers.
Looking at the overall economy, of course, we've had this rampant inflation rate here over the last 2.5 years or so here, Sean, and inflation's still above where we want it to be. The labor market and the unemployment rate, how does that affect the Fed's decision-making process as they look to try to cool the economy? Is it cooling at a rate that is going to perhaps forestall future interest rate hikes?
Only the Fed will ultimately know what the Fed will do. People like myself can only speculate. The economy has cooled in the last couple of months. I mean, the job growth rate has gone from about 400,000 a month to a little under 200,000. So that is generally, that is just a clear cooling trend. At the same time, we're still on the positive side of it, so that's good. So hopefully that's enough of a cooling to satisfy that. But ultimately, again, only the Fed knows what it's going to do.
Sometimes even they don't know until the last minute, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, who knows what they may read in their morning papers that day that will make them change their mind, or if the eggs are not done right.
Well, it can have a big impact if your eggs aren't done right in the morning. Taking a look at this inflation rate, Sean, now it has come down a bit. As you look at all the various economic numbers, you do your analysis, do you think we're on the right track with reducing inflation? Are we doing the right things? And of course, nobody has a crystal ball, but is this maybe a lull in inflation rather than a continued downward trend?
I'm of the inclination this is probably closer to a lull. I mean, one of the things is we have had considerable wage inflation. They keep going up, and there's always the possibility of a sort of inflationary spiral as a consequence of that. You know, wages go up, that causes inflation to go up, then people demand higher wages to deal with the inflation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not actually technically in the wage price spiral right now, but the possibility exists.
Congress, of course, is required to have a new federal budget in place by the 1st of October. That will not be happening once again. This sort of uncertainty that the federal government has created here, Sean, where we have these continuing resolutions, we have these budget battles, there's talk about government shutdowns. Does all of this have an impact on the business cycle, on the business community as well?
Yeah, because they have to plan several months or even years out in advance. You know, businesses are remarkably flexible. What I hear constantly from a lot of lobbyists and other sort of interest groups is, contrary to the notion of that they're sort of behind the scenes trying to manipulate things, basically what they just want is certainty and to understand exactly what the rules and the regulations are going to be.
We have been talking with Sean Higgins. Sean is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, tell us a little bit about CEI, and also what's a website where folks can go? You write extensively on this. Where can folks find that?
Well, CEI, we're a longstanding free market think tank here in Washington, D.C., where we look at things from a perspective of the less regulation is better and more freedom is always optimal. You can find us on the web at CEI.org.
Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson is at the offices of the Club for Growth. That's a good perch to keep an eye on all of the budget machinations that are going on Capitol Hill. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman.
October 1st, Scott, is the deadline for a new federal budget to be in place. So obviously, we the taxpayers should expect Congress will do their job and have the budget done by October 1st?
Well, you know, the House of Representatives is still out this week, but there are a bunch of members in town, and they're continuing the discussions with Speaker McCarthy. The United States Senate returned to Washington this week and mostly worked behind the scenes on their own plans for appropriations, as well as, you know, handling some non-controversial nominations on the Senate floor. But the reality is here that we have a real situation where there's no clear path for how the House Republicans are going to solve our end-of-the-month situation with federal funding expiring on September 30th.
So, Scott, looking at this, Kevin McCarthy has a difficult job trying to keep the Republican conference united, let alone bringing perhaps a Democrat or two on board. What is the path forward here?
Kevin McCarthy does have a number question here. We all know that he's got a very, very slim majority in the House, and you've got a number of members that are dealing with personal situations that could prevent them from voting. You've got one member, Ana Paulina Luna, that recently had a baby. She's the 12th member of Congress in the history of the House to have a baby while being a sitting member. And then, obviously, Steve Scalise, the House Majority Leader, announced recently that he's suffering from a form of blood cancer. We're all praying for his recovery and that the treatment goes well. But it's unclear whether or not he's going to be voting regularly. I imagine he'll try to make it for these big votes. And another member, Frank Lucas, also broke his pelvis recently. So he may be confined to a wheelchair, or we'll see what his voting behavior looks like this month in September. My point here is that Kevin McCarthy is trying to navigate such a slim majority and figuring out which Democrats are going to be missing votes and what that looks like for passage by a GOP unified bill is very, very unclear at this point. He's thrown out the idea of, hey, let's have some money for disaster relief. Let's have a short-term CR so we can continue our work on appropriations. And I think that there's a problem with that because any kicking the can down the road, ultimately, in the view of a lot of these members of the House, is simply just accommodating another one of these omnibus appropriations at the end of the year. So unless the members feel that there is a clear path forward for any of these individual appropriation bills to be signed into law by President Biden, they don't want to vote on them. And the other thing is, they don't want to get jammed by the Senate with a bipartisan bill that doesn't do what they need. One other thing to keep in mind, a continuing resolution funds government at current levels. Well, what are the current levels? The current levels are the same spending levels as the last omnibus appropriations bill. And so if you're going to ask Republicans to pass a short-term CR, they're basically blessing the last Biden omnibus. So there's not an appetite among the House conservatives to do that either. House conservatives, I think, are pretty united in the idea that, number one, we need to include funding for border security along with significant reforms that were included in H.R. 2. That's a bill that can pass the House. It's a Republican-only bill, but it gives Republicans leverage. Secondary, they want to roll back spending to these on domestic spending to pre-COVID levels for 2019. And I think that's a pretty simple ask because you and I both know for the last two decades, Washington's addiction to federal spending has spiraled out of control. And recently, the Washington Post even got lost. The Washington Post was saying, hey, we're not in a crisis. There's no pandemic right now. And yet, Congress is about to incur a $2 trillion deficit. That would be the first time we've had a deficit that big, or even as like a percentage of GDP, when we weren't in World War II or we weren't on the precipice of the coronavirus pandemic. So it's a lot to consider here. And McCarthy is going to be really, I think, in the middle of the zone, trying to navigate his defense against Senate Republicans and Senate Democrats that probably don't want to have this fight at all.
When you talk about an omnibus bill here, Scott, for those in our audience who may not be familiar with the term, what do you mean by that?
So Congress has two different types of federal spending. There's mandatory spending, which is not authorized by Congress every single year. It's basically autopilot spending. So if you think about programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and all the anti-poverty welfare benefit programs, those are all on autopilot. And then you have about a third of the federal budget that falls into what's known as discretionary spending. It means that Congress has discretion on what levels to fund these various agencies and programs and different line items in the federal budget. And so there are two separate categories of that, security and non-security federal spending in the discretionary categories. So there are 12 subcommittees on appropriations that break down all the different categories of federal spending. And through these subcommittees, each one is supposed to pass their own individual bill through the House and through the Senate and to be signed into law by the president. While the appropriations process has totally broken down in gridlock and the partisanship in Washington, and so it's very, very infrequent when an individual appropriations bill gets passed. Instead, Congress pushes these continuing resolutions toward the end of the calendar year up against the holidays where there's political pressure to make sure that Congress stays open, and they put all 12 bills together in one bill that could be 2,000, 2,500, 3,000 pages long.
We, of course, are going to keep an eye on all this. It's going to be a dominant issue here as we head into the 1st of October. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping us informed. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if you want to learn more about the Club for Growth, check us out at clubforgrowth.org and also on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, good talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
The federal government is spending billions of dollars to subsidize green energy companies, some of which are actually profitable. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Philip Rossetti of the R Street Institute.
The United States credit rating took a ding recently, downgraded from AAA to AA+. That combined with some of the news that we're getting about where the federal deficit might be headed at the end of the fiscal year, that of course coming up at the end of this month, the end of September, suggests that, hey, we've got a problem, folks, one that we've talked about quite a bit on this program, but one that really hasn't sunk in yet in Washington. There's too much spending. There's just too much borrowing going on. What can be done about that? One thing, as my guest today will tell you in just a moment, is that maybe we should stop subsidizing companies that don't really need the help in the first place. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is the aforementioned Philip Rossetti. He is a senior fellow at the R Street Institute, and he joins us here on the program to talk about a piece he recently published for the R Street Institute looking at how the U.S.'s credit rating downgrade might affect subsidies for green energy. Phil, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's set the table by just laying out a bit about the budget situation, the fiscal situation here that the country faces. Unsustainable is a word that keeps getting thrown around.
Yeah, it really is the best word. So last year, we spent a little over $6 trillion, and we took in a little under $5 trillion. And this is not even new that we're now at this deficit of over $1 trillion. And the problem with deficit that large, which aside from the obvious, is that our interest payments on the debt that we have is going up rapidly. So in the old days, mostly Democrats who advocated for more spending said, oh, it doesn't matter because interest rates are so low, therefore we can just keep borrowing. Now interest rates are higher. So this is huge, and if we keep spending this way, we're probably going to be spending more money on interest payments than we do on the defense budget within 5 years.
It's one of those things that I wish we could go back 10 years and I wish I could like make bets with all the people at the time who were saying, oh, it's no big deal. We can borrow. The government should borrow even all this money. It's basically free money because the interest rate is so low. Obviously, we've come to the end of that road. It's not a pleasant place to be and it's going to get worse. But this, I thought this piece that you wrote has a particularly interesting angle because it looks at one particular solution rather than saying, we have a $1 trillion deficit that we need to get our hands around, or maybe a $2 trillion deficit, as it looks like it might be at the end of this year, that we have to get our hands around. You're looking at particular things here, specifically some of these green energy subsidies in general, many of which were included in the Inflation Reduction Act a year ago, and how have they contributed to the deficit situation that we're facing right now?
That's a good question. So historically, energy subsidies were usually under $10 billion a year if you're primarily looking at tax subsidies, not like DOE or government innovation stuff, but just the tax subsidies going to companies, that was usually under $10 billion. And now with the Inflation Reduction Act, initially those increases in subsidies were supposed to be a few hundred billion, which is like $30 billion a year. And now it's looking like that was way underestimated. So the updated estimates are like, hey, actually, there's a lot more uptake of these subsidies than we expected. And as a result, now we're looking at over $600 billion cost of the IRA green subsidies. On an annualized basis, that's about $60 billion a year. And that's not an insignificant amount of money. And what's particularly interesting about the energy subsidies is when we start to look at, okay, who's taking up the subsidies, it's really companies that were already investing in clean energy. So the subsidies aren't actually getting us an environmental benefit. Some of them do, but most of them don't. So it's something like 2/3 was our estimate of the electricity subsidies that just go to activity that happened or would happen anyway. And that causes the subsidies to function as a wealth transfer from taxpayers to these companies, which are mostly wealthy Americans. So it's just bad policy all around, just enriching rich Americans at the expense of American workers.
We're talking with Philip Rossetti. He's a senior fellow at the R Street Institute. He writes about energy and climate and environmental policies for R Street, talking about why it makes a lot of sense, I think, to cut some of these energy subsidies as the federal government gears up for, I think, a season when there's going to have to be some budget cutting, going to have to be some very serious and sometimes difficult conversations about exactly what the role of government is and exactly how much borrowing is acceptable, how much spending is acceptable. Phil, I want to, in the final minute here before we have to let you go, I want to kind of underline something you just said there about, I think it's easy to think about, oh, we're subsidizing green energy. That means we're helping the environment. We're helping to slow global warming, whatever it might be. But that you know, there's a disconnect there. It's not necessarily true that federal spending on green energy or subsidizing the development of green energy necessarily has environmental benefits. And in this case, like, we're spending money that we don't have for results that don't seem to be materializing.
Right. Yeah, there are two things that can't simultaneously be true. Renewable energy can't both be the cheapest energy source available and require subsidies to be economically competitive. The cost of these technologies has fallen considerably, which is a good case to say, hey, they don't need the subsidies anymore because people are buying them wherever it makes economic sense anyway. And it's because of that the cost of the subsidies are ballooning, because it essentially is free for these people to take the subsidy and we're not actually getting new entry that wouldn't have happened anyway. And especially we're seeing like a saturation in some markets where people are just buying so much of it that they're not even using all the clean energy that they're producing. So it's definitely an overstated environmental benefit from these subsidies.
Yeah, let the market work. Let people buy this where it makes economic sense. Let private investment fill in more of the gap, which certainly would happen if the government wasn't getting in the way and crowding a lot of that out. That is unfortunately all the time that we have for today, though. Phil Rossetti from the R Street Institute, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And you can check out more of Philip's work at rstreet.org, including this piece, Will Bad Credit Affect U.S. Energy Subsidies? There's a question mark at the end of it, but you sort of get the sense that he says, yes, the U.S.'s bad credit should affect these energy subsidies. We should take a serious look at trimming some of them back. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our work online at reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
States with low or no personal income taxes are growing in population, while those with high tax rates are losing residents. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Migration trends across the 50 states continue to send a clear message. The states that embrace free market policies and lower taxes see growth, while those states that burden residents with high taxes and unnecessary regulations lose out. Texas, Florida, Tennessee, and other states without personal income taxes have been some of the biggest winners, with workers and businesses flooding in. Elsewhere in big government states like California, New York, and Illinois, millions are leaving to pursue economic opportunities elsewhere. The Rich States, Poor States Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index, a publication I co-author with Dr. Arthur Laffer and Stephen Moore, has now for 16 years ranked the states based on 15 fiscal, regulatory, and economic policy variables to determine which states are really setting themselves up for success while others still have room to improve. Combining the rankings with outcomes makes clear the difference is pro-growth policies. Some factors like the personal income tax have proved especially important. For instance, in the 9 states without an income tax, personal income grew dramatically faster than it did in the 9 states with the highest marginal tax rates. Unsurprisingly, when you tax something, you get less of it, and you tax something less, you get more of it. 2 of the top states for economic competitiveness, both states that avoid a personal income tax, Florida and Texas, gained an incredible 318,000 and 230,000 new residents on net, respectively, from the other 49 states over the last 12 months alone. Two of the highest taxed states, California and New York, respectively lost 343,000 and 299,000 residents on net during the same 12-month period. And that's just America's four largest states. In spite of this evidence, a recent report from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, a left-wing Washington, D.C.-based group, questions the connection between tax policies and domestic migration. It suggests that since Americans don't explicitly all say that they are moving for tax purposes, that taxes must not be a key factor in interstate migration. Against common sense, basic economic principles, and of course the data from the states themselves, they say that with a straight face, incredibly. Of course, moving decisions and economic policy regimes are complicated. Nobody is arguing that taxes are the only factor that lead Americans to pick up and move. In fact, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, the number one reason Americans move between states is for economic opportunity, for a job. But one of the greatest benefits of tax cuts is they enable businesses and entrepreneurs to grow and thus attract companies, both large and small, across state lines. Income taxes, by their very nature, are a disincentive against work and a direct cost for working families. An often neglected point is that businesses don't pay taxes, people pay taxes. In other words, state business taxes get passed on to consumers and workers in the form of increased prices and decreased wages, and retirees in the form of lower returns in their retirement accounts that they depend on for income security later in life. By lowering taxes and increasing job growth, a state becomes more desirable as a place for Americans to live in and work, attracting taxpayers from elsewhere. In recent years, companies like Oracle, Tesla, Hewlett-Packard, and Caterpillar, among countless others, have fled high-tax states and relocated to those with more business-friendly policies, taking jobs with them. Apple, for instance, chose to build its second largest campus in Texas, a key state that avoids a personal income tax, as we've discussed, while Nissan, Ford, and Volkswagen have built large new manufacturing facilities in Tennessee, another no-income tax state for workers. Those with a vision of higher taxes and big government, like those at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, will continue to obfuscate the data and claim that the clear trend of migration to economically competitive states has some other cause like the weather. But as California continues to hemorrhage individuals and businesses to low-tax states today, after decades of massive growth in the 20th century, it is clearly not the incredible weather of California that's a Golden State's problem. Cheerfully, for those of us who work on free market policies, continue to be validated by the American people who are voting with their feet towards states that value economic freedom and the opportunity that it brings for all. For more information, go to alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WTIM-AM in Somerville, Massachusetts, WXMC-AM in Troy Hills, New Jersey, along with WOLD-LP in Woodbridge, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.